Matters before the court for oral argument. Dennis and Linda Nelson, the appellants, are represented by Eric Smith. Stephanie and Brian Evans are represented by Jennifer Brumley and Thomas Knobber?
Knobber.
All right. Knobber.
Yes, sir.
Will appear only. Any preliminary matters?
No, Your Honor.
You may proceed, sir.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice of the Court. May it please this Court and Counsel. I represent the Nelsons, who are the grandparents in this case. Much is going to be said and briefed about parents, but grandparents are also a special class of people. They are within the subset of parents, because they have been parents, and by some definition have been successful parents, but they have a statute of their own. They are listed in 32717. And every state addresses grandparents. Grandparents on their own, the litigants in this case, have a special class of their own. This case is about three generations, all within one family, all related by blood. This case has spanned the entire lifetime of these grandchildren. I'm going to start with the quality of the relationship that these grandparents had. I know the facts are all on the record, but the facts are very important in this case, so I will just ask you to consider them. We submitted a very long petition in the very beginning of this case with a lot of facts in it, despite notice pleading. We submitted Trial Exhibit 1 and 2 and 3, setting forth just how detailed and daily and weekly was this special relationship between grandparents and parents and between grandparents and grandchildren. The reason that we did that was anticipating something that would come from that. And we wanted to show that day in and day out, there was never a mishap. There was never an event. There was never a set of overreaching by grandparents. There was never a grandparent boo-boo where they did something stupid. They had no incidents. So this was a long-standing, healthy relationship.
I have a question.
Talk about the great deal of depth of the facts in this case, and you're certainly right in that description. There's a lot been provided to us. A lot of it's very emotional, frankly. My concern is, how do we even get to those facts if we can't get to the facts that would apply under Troxell? Because it seems to me that the great weight of the evidence in the record all points to, from your perspective, how great people the grandparents are, when the real consideration in this case is the fitness of the parents to make the decision about what's in their own children's best interest. So how do we get to this bulk of evidence you've just referred to when Troxell required you to first get over the threshold of the parents' fitness?
Should I proceed? I will jump way ahead. The Troxell talked about traditional presumptions, meaning a rebuttable presumption. This court in Leavitt talked about weighing grandparent rights versus parent rights. This court in Hernandez talked about balancing parents' rights with the state's long-recognized interest in preserving relationships that serve children. Overholzer said we need a careful application of non-parental custody and visitation, a careful application. That case also confirmed what Troxell said, that these cases are to be elaborated with care. So what happened in the trial court level on this was that, for all the wrong reasons, but he came up with the idea that an intact family bolsters the idea of a fit parent. We stipulated that they were a fit parent in our petition. That doesn't mean that a fit parent can treat children like chattel. You still have the right to go in, and you have the right to have an evidentiary hearing or a trial to overcome that presumption.
So if the parents are fit, as you've stipulated to, then under Troxell, there's a presumption that they're going to act in the best interest. So what evidence is there in the record suggesting that they're not fit? How do you overcome that presumption?
The presumption isn't that they're fit.
But that they're acting in the best interest of their children.
It's an evidentiary, it's It's an evidentiary issue. It's a presumption. It's a normal presumption in the law. It's a burden of proof, just like in any other case. We should have had our day in court to present evidence that the financial dispute between these parties caused these fit parents to act in a way that wasn't in the best interest of their children and caused them to sever a relationship that served the children well.
Before you leave that issue, I want to talk about the record in this case. I didn't see in the record, and perhaps I overlooked it, but I didn't see Trial Exhibit 1. I didn't see Trial Exhibit 2. I didn't see Trial Exhibit 3. I didn't see affidavits. What I saw was I read the magistrate court's decision, and it was a little unclear to me whether the petition was, and I'm talking now about the alternative grounds that the magistrate court ruled on. I wasn't sure, was the petition dismissed? Was summary judgment granted? When I read the district court's opinion, I understood that it was affirming on alternative grounds a summary judgment ruling. And so for us to review a summary judgment ruling, we have to have the underlying documents that were used to make that determination. But I didn't see them in the record.
In the motion to dismiss, our affidavits in response to that included what I'm calling exhibits 1, 2, 3, and 4 that were attached to attached affidavits from my client and in the record, and the magistrate did comment on them, and they were in front of him, as well as a verified petition that had much of those facts in it as well. And so the magistrate said, I have all this, and despite that, there's nothing in the record. The record is devoid of any facts. And that's where I think where the justices commented, where the magistrate made the mistake of saying the analysis was just whether or not the parents were fit or not, and that is this irrebuttable presumption that he set up that it wouldn't matter if we had 333 pages of evidence about the relationship. None of that would matter because we said in the beginning they were fit parents. This is a case about fit parents.
So do we have all of the records? The affidavits and exhibits that you're talking about, are they in the record on appeal to this court?
I think so. You're actually making me question it, but I've always assumed that, and all of our briefing assumed that, and we cited it throughout our briefing.
Then maybe I've overlooked it. Thank you.
Exhibits 1 and 2 alone are 333 pages.
If, in fact, we don't have it in the appellate record, we have a rule of law that says if the record is non-existent in the appellate court, we must, in fact, presume that the trial court is correct. Do you understand that presumption?
Well, I do. But again, I've just always assumed this, and I'm optimistically confident that it is in the record. I know it was for our magistrate, and I know it was for our district court opinion, and we've certainly referred to it and referenced it throughout. I know there's been a record, and then counsel and I agreed to an augmented record, and so...
Okay.
I would hate to say something and be wrong, but...
And in fairness to you, I understand your panic button at the moment. I get it. I didn't see an augmented record, so that may be something that I've overlooked.
Okay.
So I don't want you to just... I feel you.
But at the very least, there is the verified petition.
There is, and I would stand on that alone. I really would.
Because your main argument is they're fit parents, but they've not acted in the best interests of the children, and that's a factual issue that survives summary judgment.
It does. Under the family law rules, Rule 12 and the summary judgment standard, we still get our day in court because it was predominantly unrebutted, too. So all that evidence, even if you don't, you must take it as true and view it in the light most favorable to these grandparents. The problem was the magistrate made two findings, one on a summary judgment type standard, and then two, he just looked at 32.719 itself. The mistakes he made start with the location of the statute. Nowhere can anybody cite to where the location of a statute is determinative of its meaning. So the location of the statute might be applicable, But in this case, no part of the legislative history, no part of the text itself, nothing about before or after it. This court has never interpreted the location of that statute to mean anything other than what it says, that grandparents are a special class of people.
Should we even look at the location if the statute's not ambiguous or if it's unclear, not unclear for any reason?
Not if it's a clear statute, no. I don't think so. I think we've made two complementary arguments. It's unambiguously broad. It talks about a proper showing. It talks about the best interest standard. Those are two well-versed standards. And then this court in Leavitt has added some items to it, and it is a working, functioning constitutional statute.
But so we've never applied it in this context before.
You have not, and no one can find that. One, Idaho doesn't have a lot of appellate case law, and two, it's just not a very common set of facts. The idea that the magistrate went off on, that we were going to somehow have this floodgate of litigation, is just not true, and it's just conjecture. It's a very narrow set of facts. We're talking about a very few set of grandchildren that we're trying to protect here. The location of the statute has even been admitted by the respondent in their second footnote that Title 32, Chapter 7, applies in other non-divorce situations. So really, I just don't see the strength of that argument. The other thing that the magistrate court brought up was this idea of an intact family. The problem with this is it takes a part of the analysis and it makes it the whole thing. He said, intact family, game over. But in a 719 analysis, you look to the best interest of the children. And this court said in Leavitt that the best interest is not the divorce best interest in 32717. It said the best interest of children, which must mean a totality of the circumstances type of an argument. And in the totality of the circumstances regarding children, if they are living in a stable environment with two biological parents, that's a big factor. That stability is a big factor in the overall totality of the circumstances. If the parents are divorced or there's other stressors on the family, then those are going to be factors that weigh in favor of other things. But this totality of the circumstance, the intact family, I would say, would slide in there. But this magistrate made the decision that one part of the analysis was the end result. And I'm saying that part isn't the whole. He needed to do the whole analysis. He made it actually a standing question. He took just one part of an analysis and made it a standing question. Now, this intact family, the respondent has run with this idea. And I think it is a really fragile house of cards. First of all, the respondent has created this own definition in the very first footnote of their briefing, and it's their definition that they created. It wasn't created by statute, legislative intent, or this court. And so because of that, I would say it's a faulty premise, and logically, no good conclusion can come from it. It's also a precarious argument because an intact family, meaning heterosexual mom and dad and a white picket fence with biological children, is going to bring serious constitutional due process issues to this court. How is it going to apply to the rest of Idaho's citizens, to happily cohabitating unwed parents, to legally adoptive parents who have adoptive children in their home and have gone through the legal process, step-parents, longtime step-parents, also same-sex marriage that are valid in other states? All those people would be excluded from this definition of what an intact family is. And there is no such definition anyway. So again, that is just a farce, but it also has very serious due process considerations. The Troxell case, having read that so many times to prepare for here, it's a great case, and it's just greatly unhelpful in a lot of ways too. But repeatedly, those justices talk about the modern American family. Stevens, in his dissent, says there's an almost infinite variety of family relationships that pervade our ever-changing society. And because of that, he strongly counseled against creating a rule that treated biological parents' liberty interest in the care and supervision of their children as an isolated right that can be exercised arbitrarily. So this statute is broad enough to incorporate the Nelsons, the grandparents in this case, to at least get their foot in the door. It doesn't mean they're going to win, but they get to have somebody look at this case and look at the facts of this case. It's also narrow enough to do that. They have to have a proper showing. They have to prove it's in the best interest of the children, and they have to do it by clear and convincing evidence, as Levitt has said. By contrast, the other side is saying you need to narrow this to a group of people that has all sorts of constitutional problems, and it's not supported by any evidence in the record at all that it was meant to apply that way. In fact, they're creating a new category of parental rights that has constitutional problems in it. The other misconception I think that's underlying this, go ahead.
Explain that statement to me. They're creating new constitutional problems.
If the 32719 were to apply to intact families, meaning cohabitating married couples with biological children, how could any other grandparents use 32719? They would be discriminated against, and they wouldn't be able to use that statute. And that discrimination, I think, would violate the due process considerations. Like if you had two people who validly adopt children, and they're 15 years old, and grandparents of those adoptive parents want to use 32719, it wouldn't fit under the intact family definition.
But aren't you asking us to do something we've never done before, and that is to find a grandparent's right under these circumstances?
Under these particular circumstances, but...
We've never done it before.
Meaning you've never found grandparent rights who have grandchildren, or just that it happens to be in an intact family?
In an intact family.
That's because there's only two handfuls of cases ever, and that fact pattern just hasn't come up yet. But Troxell covers this situation. Levitt covers this situation.
But not only intact families, but two parents in tandem who are saying no.
Correct. I
mean, we've never said that, right?
That is what the magistrate said as well. What we're talking about in 32719 is visitation rights, the ability for a grandchild to text a grandparent, access social media, because that serves them. There can be visits.
Send them to California?
Well, I don't know if that means that. It certainly doesn't mean they go to elk camp in North Idaho like our magistrate blew it up to be. It means visitation rights. So those visitation rights can be narrowly tailored by a trial court so that the visitation rights I'm talking about with grandparents don't even interfere with the constitutional fundamental rights that parents have. The fundamental rights in Idaho, when you have joint legal and physical custody of your child, you can direct their education. What I'm talking about doesn't interfere with directing their education. You can make all decisions regarding their medical care and their medical records. This visitation in 719 doesn't affect their ability to do that. You instruct them on their religious upbringing. This grandparent visitation statute doesn't interfere with that.
You don't think grandparents visiting with children don't have the opportunity to interfere with parents? Religious beliefs?
They do. They can. And those kind of interfering type of grandparents, like Levitt pointed out, don't get it. They don't get visitation because they violate court orders. They violate parents' instructions. But that doesn't mean no one gets to go there. No one gets to try in a situation where fit, intact families are doing things that harm their children. This did rise to the level of harm.
So I hear you arguing, I think realistically, that notwithstanding what Troxell says, which greatly stacks the deck, I think you would concede, against grandparents, it still leaves the door open a crack and requires a judicial determination based upon facts as to whether or not that decision was in the best interest of the children.
Yes, and that we embrace that stack deck. Our petition cited the Levitt clear and convincing burden of proof. We cited Troxell. We are giving that presumption. But those are just that. That's a rebuttable presumption, and it's a burden of proof. And we have the right to embrace both of those in an evidentiary sense.
You have a right to your day in court.
Correct.
To try to make your case.
Correct. And this is one part of this is a summary judgment standard. I think that those grandparent rights can be visitation rights can be narrowly tailored to not interfere with those fundamental rights and still serve the children in both ways. This idea of an irrebuttable presumption once you have fit parents, it's not in Troxell at all. You read that at all. They talk about the uniqueness of grandparents. Sure, they talk about the constitutional rights of parents because that really hadn't been set forth at the federal level yet. And so they did lay all that out. We agree with all that. We embrace all of that. That's not what we're talking about. We were handed an irrebuttable presumption that nothing mattered.
So if we explore then the width of the door that's open a crack, how big that crack is, how do you respond to the language straight out of Troxell, which says that a judge may not infringe on the fundamental right of parents to make child-rearing decisions simply because a better decision could be made?
Well, I've looked at that one. There's a couple in there that really are, in a sense, dicta, because they don't have a consensus holding in that. But what it means is that they are to be given special weight in their decisions, and that there is a presumption that fit parents act in the best interest of their children. And best interest of their children is a legal standard.
The language, though, infringe on the fundamental right to make child-rearing decisions. That's extremely broad language.
It is.
How much room is left after that?
Well, I think that if you have a grandparent who is petitioning for visitation rights, that they want them to go to certain private school and that they want them to observe a certain holiday and things like that, that's infringing. If you're talking about the ability for children of the Z generation to text their grandparents and have social media with their grandparents, that's not interfering with any of those fundamental rights. That's the balancing that you talked about in Overhoser. That's the weighing that has to happen. That's the hard work, not just dismissing this.
And but in Overhoser, you had a much different situation. You had a mother who was very supportive of the grandparents' position, right?
They are different facts, yeah. Different facts, different statute. But it's the idea, the hard work that it takes to find what is really best for children in this three-generation setup. I have run out of the first period of time that I allocated. I do want to come back, though. Thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of the respondent.
Thank you,
Good morning. May it please the court, clerk, and opposing counsel. I represent the respondents, Brian and Stephanie Evans. They were married on May 22nd, 2005. They're coming up on 15 years of wedded bliss, they would tell you, for the most part. They have three children. They are ages 13, 11, and 8, and they are all girls. I do certainly respect and understand the emotional aspects of this case. It is an emotional case for both sides. But this does start at the core of the 14th Amendment. 14th Amendment, which is the protection against government interference into individuals' fundamental rights. And one of those fundamental rights that has long been recognized is the care, custody, and control of your own children. That right is infringed upon by Idaho Code 32719.
But do you argue that in the response brief?
That it's infringed upon?
Do you bring the constitutional challenge? And I guess as I was reading the briefing between the two parties, there seemed to be a discussion of to what extent your clients are
No, we are not arguing that 32719 is unconstitutional. That was actually argued initially with Judge Combo, the magistrate judge, in the beginning. He did not go there. And so in light of his decision, we chose simply to follow the appellate, the appellant and what their issues were and not bring a constitutional challenge to the statute itself.
Okay.
So the question, though, is then how far does the gateway open for grandparent visitation pursuant to 32719? Or I believe, as Justice Mueller said, the door. How far does that open? We've talked about Troxell today. We talked about Leavitt today, and what we haven't mentioned yet is that the state enacted in 2005 statutes that codify a parent's fundamental rights, and that's under 32.10.10 through 32.10.13. And those specifically highlight some very important rights that subsequent to Troxell our legislature enacted. The right to nurture and direct their child's destiny, including the upbringing and education. It also specifically states parents with legal custody have the fundamental right to make decisions regarding the care and control of their children. And those new statutes run hand in hand with the interpretation of the magistrate judge of 32719 and that it does not allow an independent cause of action outside of a divorce.
Given what 32 11110 or 10 10 10 13 say, do you disagree with appellant's position that the presumption set forth in Troxell, as informed by Idaho code now, is a rebuttable presumption?
I believe it's a rebuttable presumption.
So
I don't
if
think
it's a rebuttable presumption, then why didn't they present enough evidence to get their day in court?
Because in all of that evidence that was presented, it was simply about the relationship they had with the child. What they have to show is that the parent's decision is not in the best interest of the child. And that was what was lacking. What the magistrate judge talked about is the fact that these parents did not live with these children. These parents had not abandoned these children. These parents had not had a relationship other than a normal grandparent-child relationship, which arguably means that anyone, although we have grandparents specifically cited, but you're talking about just a normal relationship you could have with a care provider, you could have with an aunt, an uncle, and other individuals. And when you are talking about that fundamental core right of parents' rights to decide, it has to be more than just saying, I had a good relationship with my grandchildren, now override their decision that I don't get to have contact.
So what more do they have to prove?
They'd have to prove that there's a detriment to the children in some way or that their welfare is being harmed. If you go back, Your Honor, to also under 32.10.13, where it cites specifically that you have to have an essential compelling government interest in order to infringe. And in this case, the question becomes, what's the compelling interest that is being infringed? Well, what's the compelling interest here? And that is visitation by a grandparent. And is visitation by a grandparent a compelling interest? We know that oftentimes the courts will say the welfare of children will allow then the courts to step in and make a decision overriding that of a fit parent. But then is visitation a compelling interest that should allow an overriding of that fundamental core right that parents have? And in
is
this,
that the type of fact you think can be decided on summary judgment?
I do, because they had their full opportunity to show, which is why my clients, we did not rebut or respond or put anything else into the record in response to those affidavits, because we know in the summary judgment standard, everything is in favor, in a light most favorable to the moving party. So for us to deny, for us to argue, is really a moot point at the summary judgment level.
So what should a petitioner then, like the ones in this case, do if they want to prevail with similar facts? Do they actually have to get a home study done showing detriment to the grandkids if a visitation isn't allowed? I'm just wondering what if there is any pathway to the promised land under your analysis of the case.
That's a good question. I think that it exists. I think there has to be the ability to present on a threshold that the welfare of the child is being affected.
So how do they do that then? That's
well,
the one I'm trying to figure out.
I suppose if there was evidence or record of a child missing the grandparent, of a child vocally voicing a concern that they hadn't seen that grandparent
how
in a window of time.
How do they do that without discovery?
How do they do that without discovery? Well, it would have to be prior to filing of the petition. There would have to be evidence that came through prior to the filing.
But if the grandparents preclude access to the granddaughters, how could the grandparents make that case?
They would have to do it based on the information prior to filing.
Why couldn't they show that it would be in the children's best interest to have a relationship with the grandparents? That is to say, not that the decision that the parent, that the children are being harmed by the parents' decision not to allow the relationship, but why couldn't they demonstrate that the children would benefit from the relationship? That is to say that they've had an excellent relationship in the past and that continuing the relationship would be, we used to, when I was in doing trial work, we had an expert who would testify about the nature of parent-child or grandparent-child relationships and the inherent benefit of them. Why isn't it enough to say that it's beneficial?
Well, Your Honor, I think because the beneficial aspect doesn't override the parent's constitutional right to make those decisions.
So basically, you're arguing there is no grandparent. There is no chance for grandparent to have any visitation if the parents don't allow it.
No.
You just indicated that the grandparent, even if you could show beneficial attributes to the grandparent visitation, it's still trumped by the constitutional right.
No, because I think obviously there is a threshold that has to be met, though.
And the parent.
Well, no, that the grandparents have to show that the fit parent's decisions are not in the best interest of the child. That's what...
That's something different than damage to the child by lack of visitation.
Well, or in the inverse, you could certainly argue that welfare of the children, as far as the benefit of the parents-grandparents relationship in the inverse, is a detriment. But you have to have that showing, and that's what we didn't have in this case. I think that showing can be made.
In circumstantial evidence?
I don't think there's a limit. I think it can be circumstantial evidence.
Okay. Isn't there circumstantial evidence in the petition that was sworn to by the petitioners that this would be in the best interest of the children?
Well, I think my recollection is simply that there was a relationship and that there was a bond with the minor children, and the judge found that that was not sufficient to override a fit parent's right to decide.
So are you basically saying that without expert testimony, you can never prove that grandparent visitation would be beneficial?
No. I think it's fact-specific, though. I don't think it would require expert testimony.
Okay.
Why don't they get their day in court if that's the case?
Because they, in this case, they didn't meet the threshold. But I also think that the...
How did they fail to meet the threshold of showing that it would be in the best interests of these grandchildren to have a relationship with their grandparents?
Because they didn't show that their welfare would be affected.
So if we go through the 330 pages that were submitted in Exhibits 1 and 2 and disagree, we should reverse?
Well, I think you need to get to the first question before you got to the summary judgment argument. But certainly if you get to the summary judgment argument and you determine that the magistrate did not make an appropriate ruling, then you would have to review those facts and make that finding.
You talked about a threshold question, and I'm not sure I understand which.
Well, the initial question today is whether or not a grandparent can even bring an action pursuant to 32719 within the intact family. That question, from my perspective, has to be answered first before then you even assess whether or not a claim should have been appropriately dismissed pursuant to summary judgment.
Is there a statutory definition of an intact family?
There is not.
So where did we get this concept?
Well, what I will say is instead of using the term intact family, I would use the term outside of a divorce. Meaning, in this context, because, again, 32719, as you've seen...
So parents have cohabitated for 10, 15, 20 years, and they've had children and raised them, they're not allowed? That would be a bar to any grandparent?
I think that's a good question, Justice Burdick, and I don't actually have the answer to that because
well, it seems
I think...
like you're arguing that, is all I'm saying.
What I'm arguing are the facts of this case today. And I think this court obviously has to look at the implications of its decision. But for this family who is married and for this family who had the grandparents bring an action under 32719, which falls under the divorce statute, we are asking you to make a ruling that in this case, when you have two married parents that don't agree with visitation, that they're not allowed to bring an independent cause of action as a grandparent against a married couple.
If we were to adopt the definition of intact family that's contained in footnote 1 of your respondent's brief, is there any way that would be able to withstand constitutional muster under due process or equal protection grounds?
Well, Your Honor, the discrimination aspect has been brought up, and unfortunately it was brought up in the reply brief of appellants in this case, and so we did not have an opportunity to really respond to the idea of the discrimination aspect.
So I'm asking you about the language that you put in your brief and that you say is the definition of intact family. I mean, there's all kinds of classes we can come up with, but the most obvious one is adoptive parents, and the grandparents of adoptive children would be completely left out if we adopted your if we accepted your definition of intact family.
I don't disagree. And again, in this context, I understand that this court has to look at the broad perspective of this, so should it so choose, But also, we are asking as for this particular family, when you're talking about the context of 32719 within the divorce statute, can they or can they not bring an independent cause of action? That's what we're asking.
So I understand the argument over statutory interpretation and whether it gives rise to a separate cause of action for grandparents. I understand that. I also understand that the magistrate court made an alternate ruling. Mm-hmm. And I want your characterization of what it is that the magistrate court held in its alternate ruling.
Not pursuant to 32719, but just as to the merits of the case. I filed a motion asking to dismiss, and in light of that, when the appellants filed affidavits in response to that, the court took it then as a motion for summary judgment, as opposed to simply a motion to dismiss pursuant to the pleadings. Under that standard of summary judgment, Judge Combo found that there was not sufficient evidence to grant the grandparent visitation as pled through pursuant to the verified petition as well as the affidavits that were filed. And so his decision was to dismiss on summary judgment.
What were the factual findings that he made? And I guess what I'm really getting at is I'm looking at the last couple of paragraphs before his order. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that it's the paragraph that begins in the instant case. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that his justification in that paragraph is all legal. That the parents have not abused, abandoned, or neglected, that they're fit, that they haven't been in the grandparents' custody for an appreciable period of time. I mean, what he seems to be doing is ticking off, okay, it's not a Stockwell case, it's not falling under all the vehicles, if you will, that we outlined in one of our Doe cases recently, that the idea that there are lots of different ways to get to petition for custody of children. But he's raising legal arguments. And then he says in the next paragraph, for the above reasons, even were the court to have found standing, there's not a sufficiently pled and legally supportable cause of action under the unique circumstances of this case to permit the matter to go forward. So my question is, did he really make any factual determinations or even so much as grapple with the factual information that was given to him about the grandparents' claim?
Well, in light of the fact of what he finds with no abandonment, no neglect, that there's a concession, that they're fit, that they didn't reside together, that would infer to me that he had reviewed the affidavits and the information that had been provided to come to that conclusion. So I would assume, based on that he had reviewed that documentation, and that from his perspective, in light of what Troxell has said, but also what Levitt talks about in bringing Troxell in, that in fact, Levitt didn't bring Troxell in, but the two together, that there was not the threshold met for him to proceed on the merits of the case on a summary judgment.
Okay, but he never got to the issue of whether it was in the children's best interests.
He does not comment on that. I will give you that, Your Honor.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right. So I wanted to just talk a little bit about the ambiguity aspect of the statute. And maybe clarify a little bit of the disruption or the commentary by appellants in their reply brief. On page 28, they talk about, I'll quote, the Evans suggests that both parties believe Idaho Code 32719 is ambiguous. This is not true. The Nelsons have argued the plain language of the statute allows for an independent visitation action, and statutory construction rules should only apply in the alternative case of ambiguity, unquote. Up until that point, candidly, it had been unclear to respondents whether they were arguing it was ambiguous or not. But in citing what the respondents have provided in their briefs, specifically to the Supreme Court brief, there were two at the district court level where they argued ambiguity. But also in the appellant's opening brief on pages 18, bottom, into 19, the appellants argue, quote, the magistrate court's main legal premise, for example, Idaho Code 32719 lacks wordiness and criteria, suggests, if any, that the statute is ambiguous as a matter of law. This is the appellant's words. So that's where we came up with the concept or the statement that, in fact, both sides agreed it was ambiguous. They also state again in their opening brief on page 20, quote, the magistrate court should have recognized the absence of restrictions in Idaho Code 32719 as a sign of the legislature's intent to allow for independent visitation actions, or at most, as a sign of statutory ambiguity.
Can I stop for a second? I'm questioning your assumption that this is something that was a concession by the appellant. The language that you're citing says that the magistrate's main legal premise suggests, if anything, where in that do I see a concession being made by the appellant on this case? I think it's just an observation of the nature of the magistrate's decision and responding to the implications of that.
So were you... I apologize, because are you talking about the first quote I just gave or the second one?
Yeah, I'm talking about the bottom of page 18 of the
brief. Where the magistrate's main legal premise and that the statute is ambiguous as a matter of law.
Suggests, if anything, I don't see that as a concession.
But they go on to say below that the magistrate should have expanded the analysis to include public policy and legislative history considerations. So if you're conceding that the magistrate should have done that, those are only done under statutory construction
analysis. But shouldn't it be read that if the magistrate was correct, then the magistrate should have done that? I mean, again, I think they're just going with the magistrate's decision and respond to it, not necessarily conceding their legal position.
That may be in that statement. You could come to that conclusion. But again, they even on next page, on page 20, say, or at most, as a sign of statutory ambiguity, and again argue that legislature's intent should have been assessed. And so I don't think it's clear. I think they do argue both positions, and I think that they don't disagree in certain points that the statute is ambiguous. I didn't quote from the original district court appeal, but there are also concessions at the district court level that it's ambiguous. So when we look under statutory construction, in citing the INRI, the adoption of DOE, the district court talked about how you have to look at the plain words, you have to look at the context, public policy, and the legislative history. I don't think the plain words help us. There isn't anything in 32719 that says you can bring an independent cause of action. And so that makes it ambiguous. At the same time, we know legislature has, in fact, drafted legislation that can be specific to bringing bringing your own cause of action, specifically the de facto custody statute. Ironically, there is actually, in fact, a statute, I don't know if this court's familiar right now, in the legislative session. It was passed yesterday by the Senate, so it is headed to the House, specific to grandparent visitation. In that legislation, it's Senate 1322, they are discussing making a new and separate section, independent of the divorce statute, creating Idaho Code 32, Chapter 18. So this court could certainly infer that the legislature is well aware of where the current statute sits and is well aware of its need or its ability to create an independent cause of action for grandparents should it have wanted to initially when it put it under the divorce statute.
I think that concept of statutory construction applies to two different statutes that have already been passed, as opposed to the presumptive passage of some bill. Yes, we can take into consideration changes to the law to show that maybe something has changed or that in fact the legislature meant something to stay because they didn't mention it in the new bill, but I'm not sure we can go as far as you wish us to.
Well, then let me point to some past actions by the legislative history that I think also point in the direction.
Well, I think that would be more appropriate.
Yes.
Thank you.
The Nelsons comment in their opening brief on page 23 that in 1986, before the statute was made into 32719, that legislature rejected a limitation on grandparents' rights that would have made it subject to existing custody actions. I'll respectfully disagree with the appellant's position that this, in fact, is benefiting their argument or bolsters their argument. It doesn't help their position because the idea that legislation knew what it was doing, and while they didn't adopt language that it had to be in a custody action, they subsequent to that legislation that they rejected moved 32-1008 into 32-719 into the divorce statute. Thereby, you can surmise or you can draw the conclusion that although they didn't adopt legislation that said it had to be subsequent to a custody action, They have now dropped a statute that was outside of the divorce context into the divorce statute, knowing full well that it would bring about and only arise for grandparent visitation in the custody context or divorce.
How dangerous, though, the chief talked about drawing inferences from legislation that hasn't been passed yet. We don't know if one legislator feels that way and is sponsoring the bill or if 105 feel that way. But now we're talking about legislation that wasn't passed and drawing inferences from that. Why should we ever infer, because a bill doesn't pass, that our legislature had any conclusion from that? There's all kinds of reasons why bills don't pass.
I don't disagree with that, but because our case law says part of the analysis for statutory construction is legislative history, it is something to look at and to review.
Would you agree with me? The legislative history of what has been passed is far more influential than what hasn't been passed or what might be passed.
I believe it is far more influential, which brings to the point that 32719 was passed. It replaced 32-1008, and it specifically replaced it, putting it into the divorce statute. Again, bringing the question, which shouldn't be ignored, of they specifically placed it there, knowing that it was the divorce statute and it would fall within the context of divorces. Additionally, there is also, going to the legislative history, the predecessor, well, the appellants argue that the predecessor, 32-1008, was an automatic independent action for grandparent visitation regardless. And what they don't talk about, though, and cite is the dissent in Stockwell actually comments about 32-1008. And what the justice said is, recognizing that 32-08 allowed grandparents to obtain visitation when parents were divorcing. So the magistrate specifically discussed using 32-1008 when parents were divorcing. It is the only case that we were able to find that comments on 32-1008, and that is the only comment about an independent cause of action with regards to 32-1008.
Of course, that language, when they are divorcing, does not appear anywhere in 32-108.
No, it doesn't. No, that was the magistrate's statement.
And that was based on a dissenting opinion in which it added those words to the statute.
It did. That was that justice's interpretation, but there's nothing else anywhere.
It was Viceland.
Let's see. With regards to, you know, this court obviously has been inundated with persuasive law, if you will, or out-of-state law. And so certainly for you to choose how to address that, how to incorporate it, if any way, because it's obviously not binding. But we, as counsel has said, have little authority here in the state of Idaho as to what past courts have felt about or believed was appropriate in these circumstances. We did talk in our response brief about a case by the name of New Phase Investments, LLC versus Jarvis. And in that case, it was interpreting 32912, governing control of community property rights. We simply cited to that, again, as an example of statutory construction, where the court, this court, in fact, looked at the overall language within the statute and the context of the statute to determine that it only applied to married couples in that case. It did not apply to third-party creditors. The Nelsons cite a case by the name of DAF versus Latou. I don't know if I'm saying that right. And it was October 7th of last year that that decision was made by this court. And they argue that that case supports that 32719 is unambiguously broad. All I would say in that context is that that case was interpreting Idaho Code 69031, which is a very, very different statute than what you have in front of you. With all due respect, it seems like a strained analogy. It seems like a very difficult one to make between 32719 and 6903, which is articulating, you know, what essentially talks about liability for governmental entities of a private person and what damages they could get. And this court found that common law as well as statutory remedies applied in that circumstance, and I just don't know how you analogize that case to this case. So I'll respectfully disagree with appellant's analysis in that.
There isn't anything in 32719 to suggest that it is exclusively limited to divorces.
There is not, Your Honor. It is extremely small, extremely vague. It does not limit it, except to the extent that it is ambiguous and therefore requires statutory construction or review of this, of how, meaning legislative intent, meaning where it is found within the context of the statute. And as both the magistrate and the district court found, and we agree, is that it's within the divorce statute and therefore would require a divorce in this case for an independent cause of action. I have a couple minutes left. I think we've covered the summary judgment piece. I was just going to briefly talk about the discrimination arguments that have been brought. I would just note that, assuming for the sake that married parents and all other types of parents are similarly situated, the equal protection analysis is not as simple as the Nelsons are suggesting. Because we didn't have an opportunity to brief, because it was just brought up in the reply brief, there is a case I'd like to cite. It's not binding. It's an Illinois appellate case, West versus West, 294 Northeast 2nd, 1215. And this is found at 1220-21, where the Illinois court specifically grappled with this issue. It says, the disparate treatment of married parents versus divorced or widowed parents could arguably give rise to an equal protection argument. This can quickly be dispelled. Our Supreme Court held that there is a legitimate basis for distinguishing between a disrupted family and an intact family, because in a disrupted family, especially one disrupted by divorces, the parents may not be willing or able, or because of mixed feelings about their ex-spouse, they can't consider the best interest of their children. The legislature is not restrained from remedying a particular problem merely because that problem exists for one group of individuals and not another. Therefore, it's not a violation of divorced or widowed parents' equal protection rights for the state to allow grandparents to seek visitation privileges, because the problems that arise after death of one parent or divorce are not usually present within the intact family. The other question in this is, if it was in fact discrimination, why is it so many other states are doing it just as we have proposed? Meaning in Oklahoma, very specifically, their statute says, under no circumstances shall any judge grant the right of visitation to any grandparent if the child is a member of an intact nuclear family and both parents of the child object to granting visitation, of which there's been no constitutional challenge that I'm aware of.
That's a policy choice that the Oklahoma legislature very clearly made. Is there any indication that the Idaho legislature made such a policy choice?
I do not have that indication, Your Honor. My time is up. Thank you very much for your time.
How much time does the appellant have?
9 minutes, Your Honor.
Sir?
Thank you. We started this some years ago embracing Troxell. We embraced Leavitt. We embraced that heightened scrutiny, that presumption, that clear and convincing evidence. We even embrace the idea of harm. Troxell talks, not definitively, about many states have the idea that there needs to be harm in there, as well as talking about presumptions and also talking about children who are cut off completely from the grandparents, being different from children where there's a fight about the day in and day out stuff. And so in this case, we have children who are completely cut off, and we even brought up the idea of harm. At the trial court level, we had an affidavit by an expert witness, a PhD-level child psychologist, and she opined, after reading these exhibits, that this was a close family relationship. There was an emotional attachment with the grandparents. There was an emotional bond with the grandparents. That there was a sudden and abrupt termination, and the sudden and abrupt termination wasn't caused by the grandparents and wasn't caused by the grandchildren, and that sudden and abrupt termination was harmful to the children, that it causes harm and it causes future harm. She opined that grandparents play a vital role in grandchildren's lives. It's a unique relationship, as I mentioned in the beginning, and that the love, nurturing, and acceptance from grandparents is so different than no other adult, even parents, can give that to a grandchild. Grandparents are special litigants. They are their own class. She ended with saying that the peer-reviewed current state of behavioral science was that it's detrimental to the welfare of children to terminate otherwise healthy relationships with their grandparents. So we feel like we anticipated and hit all of those factors. But in this case, there was a unilateral, an abrupt termination. If you don't agree with me about money, you will never see the girls again. And that was based on spite and just good old-fashioned greed and vindictiveness. That wasn't in the best interest of these children.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
I hate to raise your anxiety level again, but do you have a record cite for that?
I do not, but I'm comfortable that it's in there, as I can be. So, Mr. Justice, you explained that maybe there was a small door opening, and that's all we want is a small door, because we want the analysis to be between the special litigant, a grandparent, in their special phase of life, and their visitation rights, which is a whole other breed of rights, versus a parent's fundamental constitutional, legal, and physical custody of their children. We feel like the balance and the analysis can happen. These grandparents have a statute that allows that balancing test and allows that analysis. This court in Stockwell and Ewing, citing Troxell, even talked about that children have rights. Children have the rights to maintain relationships that serve them. They have the right to maintain those relationships. Why? Because it is in their best interest. That best interest is the totality of the circumstances, and that includes what is best for them. And you asked counsel before, could there be a difference between what's beneficial for them and just what their parents have said? And so what's in the best interest of children is what makes them thrive. And obviously this multi-generational passing of information and ideas is in their best interest.
Counsel, did the appellant concede that the statute in question here is ambiguous?
I think we all argued in the alternative because of the unfortunate magistrate opinion was, and then even on the district court level, it was just affirmed. And so to engage in statutory construction, you have to have the premise that it's an ambiguous statute. And so for us to say, we didn't like your statutory interpretation anyway, so we'll go down that way. Here's how it should have been interpreted. And by the way, there's no legislative history that supports your position. There's nothing in the context of this statute that supports it, and there's no case law. So in order to brief it fully and not leave that huge section out and not reply to it, we did that statutory construction. But again, it's prefaced on the idea that there's some ambiguity here. Again, not to talk out of both sides of my mouth, but I said it before, we think it's unambiguously broad. The legislature took this special class of people, grandparents, and gave you a very broad statute that has standards in it. It's been interpreted to have a burden of proof, and it is unambiguously broad, grandparents. They have the right for visitation. It's also not as narrow as they've done, unambiguously broad, and it's very specific. The reason why it's important that it's very specific is I think it survives the Troxell analysis. It really does, especially bolstered by these courts' opinions in Leavitt and how you apply it. A trial court could apply 32.719 unconstitutionally, but on its face, it's constitutional, and in this case, it could be applied constitutionally because it is narrow enough. So it's unambiguously broad, and it's also narrow enough to survive that kind of scrutiny. I don't want to comment too much about all the legislative history and the current state of the legislature. I just don't put too much credit on that. We both briefed it. You have that in front of you. If they haven't said it, it hasn't happened yet. And they have said and affirmed 32.719 in its current state. Again, I would end that children have rights. They have rights that serve them. And that children aren't the chattel of their fit parents.
Thank you. Number one, I'd like to thank both counsel. I thought both of you did a very fine job. Very
emotional and tough, tough situation, but this matter is now under advisement. We'll render a decision. Thank you.
If the students wish to ask questions.